Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. If you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. Now, if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, you can all do me a big favor, so please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts. They're going to be discussing ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, I can tell you right now that you are going to want to forward this show because it is one that is going to affect all of us. But before we get to that, we're going to our segment of Where in the World is Gabriella? Hello, Gabriella. Maybe she's so far. So, Bobby, if you're monitoring, where in the world is Gabriella?
Gabriella is in New York City. At this very moment, she's doing a school assembly for about 400 kids, so it's quite something in there. She has been busy. We have been through many, many states, and she is spreading that word of kindness.
Well, and that's what it's all about. And again, for those that haven't heard the show before, Gabriella is our ambassador to kindness. She is on a 2-year mission with her Dare to Be Kind movement. And that's really what it is. It's a movement. She's going into different states, different countries, different counties, environments. She's going in and she's spreading kindness. And she has a challenge for everybody. And that challenge is find someone within 2 miles of yourself and do an act of kindness. And the odds are they'll pass it on. So for everybody out there, that's your challenge at this point, is just do an act of kindness, and we hope that it will pass on. And I just love the fact that this is one way that Gabriella is making a positive difference in the lives of all of us. So, Bobby, is there a chance that she can break away for a moment, or to give us a message, or for us to break into what's going on right now in the school?
Let me check that out real quick. Well, it looks like she's in a pretty depth conversation. I'm not able to get her attention. I do so apologize.
It's no problem at all.
I'm trying.
It's, no worries. You know, Bobby, you know what's great is sometimes when we're calling, she's in the car, she's on her way to another venue to be able to speak. So I just love the fact that she's out there doing it. And again, I just want everybody to understand her challenge. Do an act of kindness. Do it today. Do it every day and see how it changes the people around you's life as well as your own. So, Bobby, thank you. Please. Thank her.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for following us, Alan. And one thing's for sure, she is in motion. So I do hope I'm able to speak quickly, but I'm sure she'll be back on your show.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay.
Now for everybody out there, I'm going to read a piece out of our guest's book, and this was a recommendation that came. Ever wonder why you are thinking of someone and moments later they call or connect to you? Is it magic? Is it coincidence? Maybe not. New information on what we call phenomena is brilliantly shared in our guest's must-read book. New pathways of the mind will open and perhaps shift your perception of reality, time and space, and above all, consciousness. So, and it's ended with the words, bravo. And this is a quote from Goldie Hawn after reading our guest's new book. So our guest today, Mark Gober, is not a scientist, or is he a philosopher? He's a businessman. And he began his career in 2008 in New York as an investment banking analyst with a global firm, and that was during the financial crisis. In 2010, he chose to leave Wall Street to join a technology-focused investment bank and strategy firm, of which he is currently a partner in Silicon Valley. Now, as an undergraduate at Princeton University, Mark studied the invisible forces that govern the universe that secretly drive human behavior. When he graduated magna cum laude with a degree in psychology, focusing on behavioral economics, and wrote his thesis on Daniel Kahneman's Nobel Prize-winning prospect theory, then in 2016, he stumbled across podcasts that exposed him to new ideas that put into question the most basic assumptions about who and what we are as human beings. The more he researched, the more he realized that he needed to rethink everything that he thought he knew. Now, when he started telling friends about his research, they told him it changed the way that they looked at life, and their lives started to improve. Well, after enough people said this, he realized that it was time to share his research with a broader audience so he could help more people. Now, through his new book, The End of Upside Down Thinking, podcast, and other content, he invites us to join him on his journey towards completely new mindset and worldview. Well, Mark, normally I would introduce the guest to the show, but I and our listeners at Answers for the Family accept your invitation. So it's now your show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, you know, I had a chance to go through the book, and one of the quotes that I also thought was pretty amazing was that your book has been described as Stephen Hawking's, you know, A Brief History of Time meets Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now. So what is your definition, or what do you mean by upside down thinking?
Upside down thinking, as I conceive of it in the book, is the conventional thinking in much of science today and much of just modern society. And it's a philosophy really known as materialism in scientific circles. And I'll explain what that is. It basically says the following: that 13.8 billion years ago, the universe started with some big event. It's typically called the Big Bang, and it filled the universe with physical material that we call matter. So my table is made out of atoms of matter, the physical stuff. That's why it's called materialism, because we start with matter in this big universe. So in this universe, we have lots of matter now that there's been a Big Bang, and with that much matter in the universe, we're bound to end up with atoms that start interacting with each other. Chance tells us that will happen, and we call that chemistry. It's just the interaction of atoms. Mm-hmm. So now we have chemistry in the universe, and with enough random chemical reactions in this big, big universe, chance tells us again that we'll end up with a molecule that can replicate itself. So that's like DNA. So DNA leads to the evolution of biological organisms, like a human being, which then develops a brain. And from the brain comes consciousness. And when I say consciousness, I mean our subjective inner experience or awareness. When I say that I am speaking to you right now, mm-hmm. I is what I mean by consciousness. So this is the upside down thinking, as I conceive it in the book, that we start with matter and we end up with consciousness through a brain. What I propose as an alternative, which many scientists are now starting to endorse, is the idea that consciousness, rather than coming at the very end out of the brain, actually comes at the beginning of the chain. So consciousness is primary. As the Nobel Prize winning physicist named Max Planck said, this was back in 1931, he said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental, and I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." So this is what I mean by an end to upside down thinking. It's not matter that creates consciousness through a brain, but rather consciousness is more fundamental or basic than matter.
So you also, I know that you talk about telepathic abilities. So how does consciousness then relate to telepathic abilities? Where is our consciousness then allowing us to connect with other people? And for some reason, have we tried to hinder that or stop that as a culture?
Yeah, so this is directly relevant to this idea that consciousness is primary. And there's an analogy that I use in the book from Dr. Bernardo Castro, who says that we should imagine that reality is like a stream of water, where water represents consciousness. And each of us is like a whirlpool within that stream, meaning that we're made of water, i.e. consciousness, but we have these apparent boundaries. So it seems like there's a my life and a your life, and we're all separate, and we have our own individual experiences. But fundamentally, we're connected as part of the same stream of consciousness. Now, if we adopt that analogy and we say, well, what happens if someone's whirlpool opens up a little bit and allows in water from another part of the stream or from someone else's whirlpool? That would be like consciousness from another person entering the consciousness of me, for example. So that mm-hmm. would be like a telepathic or psychic ability. So that's at least what this model of consciousness would predict, that consciousness isn't localized to the body, it's not stuck in the body, but rather it's non-local. And if the brain is acting almost like an antenna that's picking up consciousness from outside, then something like telepathy would be possible. And telepathy is one of the examples of psychic abilities in the book that I describe as being scientifically now shown to be true. But also it's something that seems to be innate in all of us, even though it's sometimes subtle.
Now, is there anything that allows any one person to connect better? In other words, what is it that we can do to be able to connect better with our consciousness or our telepathy? Or is there anything that's now been done to us?
This is something that is being researched by those who are starting to look into these phenomena. But what comes up over and over again is the idea of kind of quieting the chatter in the mind. So going into meditative states or hypnotic or trance-like states, they seem to enhance these abilities. And another analogy, if we think of consciousness as being like the sun, and in our mind we have lots of thoughts and feelings and emotions, and those are like clouds that can sort of block the rays of consciousness from getting in. And when someone goes into a meditative state or a trance-like state, maybe they're just kind of removing the chatter of the brain and kind of unlocking the filter that's typically there so that the ability is enhanced.
Wow. I know that you also talk about precognition. So, you know, as far as knowing the future before it happens, does that fall into sort of that same category that we have this ability and yet because of the chatter or whatever it is that's going on, we're not harnessing it?
I think so. Yeah. So precognition is the idea that somehow with our consciousness, we can know the future before the future even happens. And again, if we say consciousness is fundamental and actually exists beyond space and beyond time, then it's at least conceptually possible that our consciousness could reach forward in time. But going back to your question about how can we enhance these abilities, I want to point you and your listeners to many studies that were done by the U.S. government. there was a program for more than 20 years where the U.S. government used psychic spies for national security. And I actually just had a very interesting conversation a few weeks ago with Russell Targ, who is one of the laser physicists at Stanford University who ran this program. And when I say psychic spying, I mean these are individuals who were very, very talented and were able to see things that were far away from them, not with their eyes, but with their mind alone. And when they did this, they would go into a trance-like state. And some of the CIA's internal documents, which I was able to show in my book because they've been declassified, those documents say this is a real phenomenon. It's known as remote viewing, seeing something remotely. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, even more interesting about this, your question about precognition, knowing the future before it happens, is that this remote viewing phenomenon was actually done with precognition as well. So not only were the remote viewers able to see things that were far away in distance, but they could see things forward in time before it actually happened. And some of these studies were run at Princeton University as well, where there was a lab called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, run by the former dean of engineering. But in all of these studies, what seems to be the case is that the people that are best able to do it go into this trance-like state, they quiet the monkey mind, and then they're able to, with their mind, perceive something that's far away, both in space and time.
So, I mean, is this kind of like, you know, when people say, listen to your gut, you know, I know that, and I'm here in Southern California, and we've had some horrible fires, you know, over the last few months. And I have a dear friend that about 2 weeks before the fire said, they have a horse ranch, and they said, we need to move these horses. And her husband, you know, it was, I think if you're married to somebody a long time, you just kind of go along with it. But, you know, they moved them to another state, and they finished moving them just about a week before the fires devastated the area. You know, and, you know, she couldn't explain it except that she just wanted to listen to her gut, that voice. You know, is that precognition? You know, what is it in our mind? And is that something that we just need to listen to, you know, at a deeper level?
I would say so. I think that there is, as I've gotten into this research more and more, there seems to be a knowingness that comes about that is not really a logical one. It's not something that you can fully explain, but it's just that sometimes people know to do something and don't have a reason for it. And it comes up also in dreams. And I talk about precognitive dreams in my book, where sometimes people will dream of an event before it actually happens, and it's in vivid detail. And they can't really explain how it happened, but they were able to access information. And actually, a man in Virginia dreamt 5 lottery numbers and then played those numbers and won a few $100,000. And it's like hard to explain how that knowing came in. But if we use this analogy that the brain is almost like a filtering mechanism or a receiver of consciousness, then something about the way we're receiving consciousness in certain states allows us to just know things.
Well, there's a whole bunch of people right now writing down something that's saying to them, okay, I need to find out if I can learn something from this book on how to dream the lottery numbers.
Me too. I would love to know how he did it.
yes, I could certainly see that. You know, so, you know, let me back up for a little bit, because I love the fact that we just jumped into this, you know, and I'm so interested in everything that as it relates to our consciousness, and I am of the belief that there's so much more that we can be doing. But let's back up for a little bit. Now, what drove a Wall Street, banking analysis, financial analysis guy to go, you know what? I'm going to go deeper into the mind to figure out, you know, what it is that we can learn from it.
Well, when I think back, when I was a student at Princeton, I had questions about existence, and I almost decided to major in astrophysics because I wanted to explore the universe and our place in it. But I didn't have time to do that because I was on the tennis team, and switching majors would have just been too much. So I kind of put those interests aside. And I mention that because I think the interest in life and understanding this existence has always been there. And I was just really distracted with other things for a while, whether it was tennis or working in investment banking during the financial crisis. And so the questions that I had about existence were always just put aside because I was busy. And it wasn't until around August 2016 that I heard the first podcast on these topics. And I was listening to a show called Extreme Health Radio, where they talk about alternative health techniques. I wasn't even trying to learn about consciousness. And the next podcast that came on in the queue was a woman who talked about her psychic abilities and talked about being able to communicate with entities that are not physical and working with energy and things that I'd really never heard of before. At the end of that interview, the woman, whose name is Laura Powers, said she has her own podcast called Healing Powers, where she interviews other people that have had these experiences. So I then started listening to that podcast, and over the course of a few weeks, I ended up listening to all of her episodes dating back to 2011. And it hit me. I said, wait a second, how is it that all of these people are independently describing a picture of reality I've never heard of, and I haven't been taught any of this? If any of this stuff is real, then I have to rethink my reality. And when I say my reality, I was very much of the materialist perspective that I described in the beginning, which says that everything's made of matter, and matter is what ultimately creates this awareness that we all have right now. And when you think about that idea, that matter or the brain creates consciousness because the brain's just made out of matter, then there are implications for how we think about life and meaning. If the brain turns off, in other words, when the body dies, that means under the materialist view, consciousness goes away. There are no memories, there are no feelings. It's all wiped out when you die. So for me, as someone who took that really literally, I said there is therefore no meaning in life. Because if anything happens, whether it's good or bad, or I'm happy or sad about it, ultimately, it will not matter once the body dies because there's no more consciousness. And I think it's a very nihilistic perspective, but it's the one that is implied by the materialist view of consciousness, that the brain or matter creates consciousness. And here I was listening to podcasts that were putting that very assumption into question. And so I realized very quickly, wait a second, Mark, if this stuff is real, and if it's not just the materialist view, if consciousness is something well beyond the body and the brain, then wait a second, Mark, you have to rethink your life and meaning and all those assumptions that I had. So that led me to spend a year of just nonstop research outside the office because I wanted to understand these concepts. And the more I researched, the more I found very credible scientific research, whether it was from the U.S. government or Princeton, like I said, or the University of Virginia has a division of perceptual studies that looking at this. They've been studying it for the last 50 years. And so lots of credible stuff. And ultimately, I saw so much credible research, and I was so personally impacted by it that I ultimately decided to write a book.
So, Mark, give us some of the evidence that our consciousness survives when our physical body dies.
Well, I mentioned the University of Virginia, and they study things like near-death experiences, which we can talk about, but they also have studied a phenomenon where children who are usually between the ages of 2 and 5 years old start recalling a life that is not theirs. And in over 2,500 cases, the researchers have been able to find a person through historical or medical records that aligns with what the child is saying. And sometimes these are extremely specific things. And sometimes the children have birthmarks or physical deformities that align with the way in which they describe dying in this so-called previous life. So here we have children who are taking on memories, sometimes personality traits, and sometimes even physical traits that are aligning with a person who previously lived. So that is the University of Virginia researchers to say that is one piece of evidence, perhaps, that the consciousness of one continues beyond the physical body and perhaps can go into another.
Okay, so now if we accept that, so how could mainstream thinking then be so off base? And do you think that this is a misunderstanding of our reality, or do you think it's done with intent?
I think there are strong incentives to to keep the status quo, which is the materialist view that I described, that the brain creates consciousness. When your brain turns off, that's the end. That is the conventional paradigm, which many scientists have built careers upon. And so I think it's difficult sometimes for people to switch perspectives, especially when it's one that's this big. I mean, this is really a massive paradigm shift. So I think that creates a natural resistance to these ideas. And that's something I've seen a lot in the research. And because of that, there seems to be biases against this kind of research. And I mentioned the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab that was run for about 28 years, run by the former dean of engineering. They shut down the lab in 2007. They were studying these phenomena, things of anomalies of consciousness. And though they got some of their results published in peer-reviewed journals, in the New York Times article that described the closing down of the lab, Brenda Dunn, who co-ran the lab, she said, look, it's hard to get peer review when you don't have any peers.
Yeah.
Which I think is a very telling statement. If there is the conventional paradigm in science and here people are coming in with this anomalous evidence that doesn't match the theory, there is a tendency to try to sweep it under the rug. And what I found in my research is that there is just so much evidence in independent areas that we're at the point where we can't sweep it under the rug anymore if we want to be intellectually honest.
Well, and I appreciate that. And the thought that came to mind while you were saying that was, well, there was a time in which, that there were people that swore that the world was flat. And if you said anything outside of that, you know, it was considered, you know, heresy. I mean, it was just ridiculous. You couldn't possibly go there. And I'm sure that they wouldn't at that time, want to continue to spend funds on researching that until such time as somebody proved them wrong.
That's a great analogy. And another one that I love to use is the analogy of Galileo, when he had all of his evidence in the telescope, which suggested that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, but rather the Earth revolves around the sun. That was a very challenging idea to the conventional worldview. And so there were clergymen that didn't want to look in his telescope to see the evidence. They just kind of, they didn't want to challenge the worldview. But what's been particularly interesting to me is that it doesn't seem to matter who the person is. So, for example, Brian Josephson, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, he has become interested in phenomena like telepathy and these anomalies of consciousness. And he's even said that he thinks telepathy exists and that quantum physics will prove it to be true. He was, in fact, uninvited from a scientific conference because the conference picked up on the fact that he's been interested in psychic abilities. And I'll read you a quote, a letter that he received from someone at the conference. Again, this is a Nobel Prize winner in physics. The person wrote him a note saying, "It has come to my attention that one of your principal research interests is in the paranormal. In my view, it would not be appropriate for someone with such research interests to attend a scientific conference." So he was uninvited because of his interest in these topics as a Nobel Prize winner.
Wow. I mean, you know, they might as well have just, you know, sent a video of them, you know, with their fingers in their ears and their mouth going blah, 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 blah. You know, we're not going to hear it. They covering their eyes, making noises with their mouth and fingers in their ear, as opposed to even listening to someone talk about something that, you know. And again, how did he go from Nobel Prize winning genius to uninvited? Did they think that somehow like a giant needle came out of the sky and sucked half his brain out, or he somehow got stupid? I don't know.
I really think there is just such a strong bias about this, and I don't fully understand it because I'm not an academic. I'll give you another example of a woman who was at a very mainstream U.S. academic institution on her way to tenure in the psychology department. And she was studying precognition, which, again, is this idea that we can know or sense the future before it happens, studying it scientifically. She was told, look, you have a great resume, but you should take off this precognition stuff from your resume. And she ended up leaving academia.
Wow. Yeah, it's kind of disheartening, to think about it and to think that we're still at a stage in which we want to close our eyes or turn away from something because we don't understand it. We didn't become who we are by doing that. We didn't become the beings that for the most part, control the earth by just going, well, no, we don't want to look at that, or we don't want to try to learn something else. I mean, how would we have come up with some of the incredible breakthroughs that we've had in medicine and in technology and stuff if we kept looking at things going, well, if they couldn't do it before, I guess we can't do it anymore or can't do it in the future.
Yeah, it's kind of a counter to the scientific philosophy, which is to explore the unknowns. So that, in some senses, it has been disheartening for me to research this and see that, wow, on the one hand, there's a lot of research, but on the other hand, it's not allowed to be explored by many people, or people are just afraid to because they don't want to be made fun of or be shunned. That's on the one side. But the other side of it to me that's been actually very positive is to see that there are many brave scientists that are really risking so much to study these things. And we're now at the point where there's enough credible evidence, I think, that, I mean, I was able to write a book about it and feel comfortable putting my name on it because there's just so much evidence. And I'll give an example of a recent shift, which I think hopefully will start to gain traction, is that the American Psychologist, it's a peer-reviewed journal from the American Psychological Association. So this is mainstream science. Mm-hmm. They accepted an article which has the accumulated evidence for some of these phenomena that I've described, like telepathy and precognition and remote viewing, like what the U.S. government did. Dr. Etzel Cardenya combined the statistics for the studies that have been done over many decades and shows a statistical effect. And apparently the evidence was so strong that even this mainstream journal looked at the evidence and they accepted the article. So I think it's a really positive step that's happened just in the last few months.
Yeah, I think it is too. And in fact, I think I'd love to read that as well. I'm very interested, especially with telepathy. There are times in which I have felt. In fact, I made a statement one time, and I realized that when you say something, and as the words are coming out, you're trying to pull them back, going, I can't believe I'm saying this. But I was in a meeting with some very high-level people in Hollywood in regards to a TV show, and one of the executives, I'm sitting there and I looked at him because I thought that he was talking to me, that besides the fact that this conversation that was going on with about eight people in the room, and I looked at him and he was asking me a question, and so. Whenever the next person stopped, I turned to him and I said, well, to answer your question, and I went bup, 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 bup. And he looked at me like I didn't say anything. And I said, but I said it kind of jokingly, but I just said, I must have read your mind. And then we went on with the thing. But I thought about it afterwards and I thought, he probably thinks I've lost my mind.
Well, let me give you and your listeners a sense for some of the science that's been done on this, where you can see the statistical effects that might be able to explain these instances that so many people have, whether it's the one like you described or where you think of someone and then you get a phone call or a text from that person. There mm-hmm. seems to be something happening. And this is the basic design for a study that's known as the Ganzfeld experiment, which, again, has been done for many decades across many different experimenters. You have one person in a room, we'll call him Bob, and Bob is put into a relaxed state. So he is listening to relaxing music. He's basically getting in the state, hopefully, where his mind is being quieted. Jane is in another room, and Jane is shown by the experimenters a picture or a movie clip or some image, something that's visual. And she's told by the experimenters to try to mentally send whatever she's looking at to Bob in the other room. Bob has no idea what she's looking at. And he's just sitting in his relaxed state. Jane is an everyday person. She's not claiming to be a superstar psychic, and neither is Bob. And she's trying to mentally send what she's seeing to Bob. Bob comes out of his relaxed state after a while, and the experimenters show Bob four pictures. And they say, Bob, one of these four pictures is what Jane was trying to mentally send you. Which one was it? If it were just chance, alone at play, then we would expect Bob to guess correctly one out of four times, or 25%, if it were just totally random chance. Okay, but the experimenters find, again, over many trials, when you combine the data, that it's closer to 32%. From a statistical standpoint, it's massively significant. In other words, that something is happening beyond chance that is getting through. And to me, it aligns with everyday experience. Because if we were 100% telepathic, then we would know each other's thoughts all the time. And yet that's not what happens. Instead, there are these events that happen every now and then that we can't quite grasp. And we're not sure if it was random or not. But this study, to me, suggests that some information gets through sometimes.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about how this has changed your life. Now, for everybody out there, you're listening to Answers for the Family. Stay with us. And if you would like to follow along or learn more about Mark, you can go to markgober.com. That's markgober.com. And if you're out there driving, obviously don't try to write anything down. You can always go to the answersforthefamily.com site, and we will have all of Mark's information there. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking to Mark Gober, and we are talking about his new book that is going to make you think. It is going to make you start maybe doubting a little bit about what's out there. The book is called The End to Upside Down Thinking. And when we went to break, I had just asked Mark, so how has this changed your life?
The short answer is that it's changed it very significantly. Because as I mentioned, I used to think that life just had no meaning at all, because once the body dies, then that's the end of consciousness. And we haven't spoken much about the near-death experience, but I'd love to tell your listeners about that, because I didn't know much about it before I started researching, but it's really shifted my perspective, especially after having spoken to people who've had these experiences. But the near-death experience is an instance where a person is in some kind of extreme physiological trauma. So, for example, cardiac arrest, that's where the heart stops, blood stops flowing to the brain after a certain period of time, and it's essentially clinical death. What some researchers are doing is to examine what happens to people under these extreme states, because throughout the ages, there have been reports of people hovering over their body, having a life review, experiencing unconditional love, seeing deceased relatives. These are all things that have been described since the Tibetan Book of the Dead in Plato. So researchers have started to see an increase in these cases, and they're trying to understand if this is just a hallucination or if it's something that's real. And what they're finding, interestingly, is that these memories seem to be occurring at times that conventional models of the brain would not predict. So there's a study by Dr. Pim Van Lommel, who is a cardiologist. He interviewed people that survived cardiac arrest, so after they were resuscitated and lived, and 18% of the people that he interviewed reported a near-death experience.
So that is really significant, because we would expect under the conventional model of the brain that 0% of people should be able to have such clear memories. And yet here we have people that survived cardiac arrest and they're reporting a classic near-death experience. In the most compelling cases, it's known as a veridical out-of-body experience. Veridical meaning the person is seeing things that are later shown to be accurate by those who were lucid at the time. So this is where a person's in cardiac arrest or some kind of trauma, they hover over their body, they see things, and they're by all means unconscious based on what people see of that person. The person is like lying down, they seem to be dead or not functional, and yet the person is hovering over their body and they see things in the room. When they're resuscitated, they come back and describe what they saw from the vantage point, sometimes above their body, and it's shown to be accurate. So here we have basically a functional consciousness when the body is barely functional or sometimes completely non-functional. So this is another piece of evidence that points to the idea that the brain isn't what's producing consciousness, that our consciousness isn't dependent on the body. So if we accept the near-death experience to be something more than a hallucination, and I have a whole chapter in the book looking at different arguments for this, but to me it seems like something happening here. There's something called the life review, which I mentioned, and it is really profound. This has been described by many, many people who've had the near-death experience, where they relive their whole life in a flash. They judge themselves or kind of observe how they acted towards people, but they relive the event through the eyes of the people that they affected. And in some cases, they actually feel the emotions of the third parties that were affected. And I'll give an example of that. Danyon Brinkley, who is someone very famous for having described his near-death experiences, he recently had his fourth near-death experience. So he's had one almost every decade for the last two decades. And he talks about when he was a Marine in Vietnam, there were many people that he killed. In his life review, he experiences the deaths of the people that he killed, but also he experiences the pain that he inflicted on those who were related to the people that he killed. So this is all connected to this idea that we're like part of the same stream of consciousness. And in this altered state, whatever it is, or dimension or something, we are able to switch lenses. So it's not just the individual that is experiencing it. We're able to switch into the consciousnesses of others. And to me, it's just extremely powerful to think that this is something that's so commonly reported.
Yeah, that's just, it's phenomenal. I love that. And as you were describing some of the research, one of the thoughts that came to mind was putting everything together that you've said. You talked earlier in regards to us being able to, you know, put our monkey brain, you know, at ease or to calm it down. And I'm wondering if there's part of the research to where they're saying 18%, but is this 18%? Were all of them able to be in a calmer state? You know, have they made that connection? Because I think in the same sense that we look at dreams, I know that for years I can go and not remember my dreams because I know that my brain is just I can't shut it off. And yet, you know, when I'm in a better meditative state, I find that I start getting my dreams as well. I'm wondering if that's part of the same thought process, because it's remembering. We know that we had the dream, we just don't remember it. And I'm wondering if it's the same thing about the near-death experience, is that everybody's having it, but is there only 18% that's actually remembering it?
That's a great question. When you talk to people that have had the near-death experience or people that research it, what they say is, look, when you die, you're going to have a life review. That's the knowingness that they have when they come back from the experience, that this is just part of the process of our consciousness transitioning. Now, like you say, whether or not we remember that upon being resuscitated, I think it's an open question. It's possible that this could be happening to the remaining 82% in those studies. It's just not remembered. But mm-hmm. what you ask, I think, is a really good question about the nature of memory in general. And it's something that has just consumed me when I think about these topics. Because when we think about memory, like, I don't remember what it was like to be an infant, or I don't even remember what I was doing at this exact moment 3 years ago. I don't remember all of my dreams.
So there are things in my life that were indisputably occurring during the time that I was alive that I have no memory of at all. And yet I would say that I was alive and conscious during those periods. So if we think of our consciousness as extending beyond the body, I often wonder, what is it? Are there other things that we just simply do not remember, we can't access because of the way our brain is structured?
Wow. I had to tell you, this has probably been the show that's gone by faster than any show I've ever done. I've got a couple of listener questions, and I looked up and we only have about 3 minutes or so, but I want to get these in because, again, I appreciate those that take the time to send these questions in. It's usually people that are working during the day, so they send it in the night before. So this one reads, it just keeps getting better. I've been so excited to watch all of the new science supporting what has been called woo-woo the last 40 years. We just have to keep the heat on so that the media doesn't bury it or trivialize it. I ordered your book and look forward to sharing with my family and friends who are sticking their toes in the water and becoming more and more open to these topics. And that's from Allie in North Carolina.
Well, thank you, Allie.
Yeah. And then see if this one is, it's, this one reads, the title of your book immediately captured my attention. My daughter, who is every bit of being upside down in her thinking, feels the future is pretty bleak because of what she terms a slave system that has you working your entire life away to keep your head above water. She and her husband have one child who is 10 years old, and although they both have college educations and decent jobs, they are struggling with all of the usual things. I was wondering if your book would help her and how I might approach the conversation so that she doesn't roll her eyes about another self-help book that I keep sending her away. Thanks so much. And this is from Linda in Washington.
Well, thank you, Linda. I really appreciate that note, because I wrote the book for exactly that purpose. I wanted this to be something that you could hand to a person that might be skeptical or might just be reluctant. It's a book that has over 700 citations, and it's written still for a general audience. So it's really a matter of looking at all the evidence that's there. And it's about looking at what reality is. I think it has second order effects of being self-help, because once we internalize what the science means, it affects how we look at ourselves. But I wouldn't categorize it as a self-help book primarily. And another thing that you might say is that the book has been endorsed by a number of very credible scientists, like Dr. Ed Kelly at the University of Virginia and Irvin Laszlo, who's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So you might just look at some of the endorsements to let your family members and friends know that even though Mark's a businessman, it's been endorsed by people that have been in this field for a very long time. So I really hope for your listeners that this book can be helpful.
You know, Mark, I love that answer. And you've said multiple times, you know, it's, you know, I'm just a businessman. And, you know, I think I can synergize with you in regards to that, for those of us that aren't really focused on, you know, on the credit of things, it's just a matter of that desire to find out more, to learn more. And I love the fact that the way that you've chosen to do that is you've gone out and contacted some of the top people in other fields. You know, we don't have time in this world to learn everything. So the fact that you have sought out top people that have already learned about something and incorporated that into your book and into, you know, the whole mindset of what you're doing, I think is great. And I really just want you to know that I appreciate that very much in the way in which you've gone about it and taken the time to get this information to everybody, because I think you're taking us in the right direction.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And that's really what I'm trying to do, is to just objectively show people the evidence that took me a really long time to gather, because the information is really scattered. And I saw that, and I wanted to bring it together in an easy to read fashion so that people could get caught up very quickly.
All right. So for everybody out there, I really recommend that you get the book. There's so much more information. In fact, Mark, I'd love to have you back, because I feel like we just barely touched the surface of so many great things that you have in the book. And if you have anything, a speaking engagement or something like that, you're going to be in on the West Coast, let me know. I would love to get together and see how we can help support you.
Well, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to be on your show and to speak with your wonderful listeners.
All right. Well, thank you. Now, for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will be discussing the new book, Mastering Uncertainty in Life and Business. I really suggest that you plan on listening to this one because it is another one that I think is going to help expand your mind. So, and if you get a chance, please visit our archives of past interviews. You can go to answersforthefamily.com. You can also subscribe to the show through iTunes or Stitcher or YouTube. That will have the show sent directly to you. It'll be waiting for you on your device. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people. We greatly appreciate that. Next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. Be kind to each other, be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Right here on LA Talk Radio.